I'm presenting with Jim. Everyone knows Jim. So this is our classical giving a little bit glimpse of the future talk we have been giving for 3 years now. Glad we can be here again this year. You might recall the first time we talked, we sort of gave you a preview of what we're planning to do, just having a single slide with 20 buzzwords, and then 2 years later, you could take us sort of to the bar and like evaluate how much we actually did, and we actually turned out to be mostly correct. So today we talk a little bit about what we did with the SMB3 stuff, not just in the protocols, but it's also important to look at the underlying storage changes we made in the operating system, because that leads to really a new type of file server, and it's sort of interesting to understand that. And then we're going to switch a little bit to sort of a forward-looking statement. And I have a disclaimer note in the deck, but you know how it is, like predicting the future is hard, so like don't take that too serious, but it's sort of after the doom and gloom we heard this morning, I hope I can set a little bit of a contrast. First time we came here, we talked about SMB2. And what's interesting, our code base, or the complexity of our code base at the time, really was a main driving factor that drove us to do this. So as the Samba code, as the Samba team, you were well aware, there's a lot of legacy in the old code base. And it really sort of gotten to a point where innovation had become very, very difficult. Anytime you were trying to add something into the existing protocol, you would sort of stop interoperating with something. We have about 900,000 regression tests that we run whenever we make a change. For many of these tests were written like before I joined the company. We don't know what they test for, but they're important. And so that old code base wasn't a good vehicle. So we came up with SMB2, and the biggest thing was making it simple. Just getting a new code base, clearly structured, simplifying the protocol, and taking care of a few problems. But the big sort of the ship criteria of basically getting the first version out was just basically make a new protocol that sort of continues to work with all the scenarios, but have a code base that was clean so we could basically get back on a path of innovation. And I do recall like the initial reception wasn't that great. There was quite a little bit of criticism about why we were doing that and whether we were doing it just to be basically doing something new and incompatible. But it really was mostly motivated by our own engineering organization. So we started adding the durable handles, a little better concurrency and compounding. And the other things that we started adding to our agenda back then was really branch. So we had a lot of customers getting into branch offices. And the original SMB protocol had been developed on the LAN. And so the ability to work effectively over like in branch offices with high latency links was very bad. So it was like the start to like our branch initiatives. Once we got the protocol out, we had to do a little bit of fixing, QFEs, quite a few areas, but it's all in things like as a sort of an overview, like a first version of the product, and looking at it at the back mirror, it was pretty successful. For most people, it didn't make a difference, and they were using it without even knowing it. So we were quite emboldened that we have done the right move, and we started really start adding features. So we got into the resiliency handles. We added leasing, and leasing was one of those things, when you look at it afterwards, it's simple, but our own products, specifically Office, had started basically completely violating the oplock model by opening multiple handles to the same file. That's where it's like kicking out our own oplocks. So when we were doing the analysis of the traffic on our corpnet, it was mostly the traffic caused by broken oplocks. So just adding that in cut down 45% of all the packets just disappeared from the network. So in a workload, in an Office workload, you could make 45% of the packets go away by doing something like this. So that turned out to be a good idea. And then we got this idea to doing branch cache, where you basically use a group of machines or a dedicated server as a peer network further to reduce the amount of traffic you have to send over to a branch. And then for high latency links and like fast networks, it really became key at large MTUs. We're giving you a big advantage. We have an internal 2 gigabit link to India. And like one of the interesting like back of the envelope calculations you can do is, in order to fill the pipe effectively, you have to send 11 megabytes into the ether before you can expect to get any response. Of course, like none of our stuff ever was written, and with the expectation that you had to send out so much data before to wait for a response. So we started thinking more about, hey, maybe we need different flow control algorithms for different network characteristics, like adjust that so that we work on a wide range of networks. And so that also turned out to be very successful. Once we were done with that little India example, we got calls from our IT organization and said, like, something is broken. This copy job used to run like a day. Now it's done in 5 minutes. You broke something. We fixed it. Then we got into the project, which was called SMB 2.2, and that was something different. And I know sort of there was a lot of talk today where the sort of like SMB has peaked and the importance is going down. And when we took a look at sort of the market, it became clear to us that we actually have a very, very cost-effective and very high-performance way of making storage available with SMB. But we as a company, Microsoft as a company, had opted not to make our server applications run against our own file services. So we sort of have handed the keys to the castle to companies that provide block storage. So SQL and Hyper-V, particularly in reliable configurations, do not work today with the current releases against our own storage products, which sort of in retrospect sounds like an odd decision to make, but that decision was made a long time ago. And we basically said, well, how would it look like, or would it be advantageous if you could basically just run all of your applications against file servers? And what would that look like? What are the requirements? And so the blueprint for what we were doing in SMB3 were derived by looking at all the good things people expect from Hyper-V, SQL, IIS, in terms of getting data center reliability out of these applications. So reliability and transparent failover somehow very, very quickly emerged to like the top of the list. And it's kind of interesting to think about, why didn't we do this all along? Like, why is it that when sort of you lose a server and you have like a file handle open, you basically get an error popping up and not being able to sort of automatically transparently fail that over? I mean, that is such an obvious idea. And so we started going down that route. And once you go down that route, you very, very quickly start thinking about, oh, for these cluster configurations right now, you can only ever use one machine. Sort of, even if you fail over, it's a standby. Hey, maybe we can do active-active. So we started thinking more about clustering in the lower layers of the stack as well. CPUs get more cores, but they don't get faster. Turns out, like the way the operating system, our operating system is written, when you terminate a TCP stream, you always end up on one core. Well, the network speed has gotten so much faster, but the CPUs haven't, that you start basically taking out the CPUs just with one TCP connection. So even on, if you have only a single cable, running multiple connections at the same time actually allows you to fill the pipes and basically keep the CPUs, keep the machines responsive. So multi-channel was added. And now you can just do multi-channel to single nodes, and you can fail them over, and it all started making sense. Like a lot of these technical building blocks, once you have the technical capabilities, allow you to sort of very flexibly think about building reliable systems. So when we first demonstrated this, or like we talked about this to our brethren in the SQL organization, we got like a almost violent response. They said, you've got to be joking. And so, well, why? When you say, well, you got to be able to completely fail over. Like, it's got to be reliable. SMB is not reliable. And we say, well, why is that? Isn't that completely up to us? And so we worked through them, and sort of took the feedback. And at this point, for the next version of SQL, there will be full support of SMB, not just our version, but also Samba. So if you implement SMB 3, SQL will be one of the applications you can point it against. The same is true for Hyper-V. So there's now will be official support statements for the next version of Windows Server that all these server applications will be supported and fully supported against SMB3. The big crisis hit, and storage cost as a relative portion of the IT cost in a data center keeps going up. So the capacity goes up, and like the innovation in storage technology, the density doesn't keep up with the amount of storage that's required. So storage costs more and more as sort of part of your data center. People don't like that. So all sorts of compression technologies became important, SIM provisioning, deduplication. But deduplication is sort of, again, mostly a software function, and so we figured, hey, why don't we just put that in the operating system? So we started putting that in the operating system. So with the next version of server, you will get deduplication in the box. When you think about branch cache, where you sort of have these chunks, and you just have hashes instead of downloading the full file, you ask for a list of hashes and see whether you have these segments lying around somewhere else. Well, we aligned that with our deduplication feature. So now we basically have a chunk store where we will sort of chunk up a file and compress it. And then branch cache can take full advantage of that as well. One interesting sort of technical subtlety with a fiber channel storage backend versus any network protocol is, as soon as the CPU gets involved with moving the data for the IOs, your ability to have the CPU focused on the task at hand, which might be SQL or Hyper-V, goes down. When you go to fast networks, let's say 4-10 gigabit networks, suddenly you're looking at like 40-50% of your CPU is just being spent on doing network IO. Well, when you translate that and think about what that means in a data center, that means you need 40% more machines to get the same workload done. So in order to really make a difference with SMB there, we needed something where the CPU load required to do SMB gets down to the same level of what fiber channel would need. And so we defined a mapping of SMB on RDMA technology and call that SMB Direct. And at this point, we meet or beat sort of the cycles per byte required for doing IO using SMB in a data center. And I don't know, Tom spoke yesterday whether he gave you some of the performance data. It's like we've moved way beyond what you could do with fiber channel. Like we had the interrupt show this week, and maybe you can.
Yeah, the performance numbers we showed this last week, I believe 5.9 gigabytes per second, Tom?
Gigabytes.
Tom? 5.8, apologies. 5.8 gigabytes per second from a single client to a file server. And that's using large IO. Small IO, 8K IO, around 330,000 IOPS from a single client again. So we're kind of off to the races in terms of this technology.
Those are incredible numbers. Right? I mean, that's really sort of science fiction realm. Like you just couldn't, machines don't have enough slots for fiber channel to even like remotely get to these IO rates. So this is really something new. Mm-hmm. Direct releases, we introduced leasing in 2.1, but we still sort of had the directories like being fully synchronous. And we did the analysis, looked at our information worker workload, that again makes 25% of the remaining packets completely disappear. So one quarter of the packets are going to be gone as soon as you turn on directory releases. So again, for branch offices, this is a great technology. The problem with introducing or positioning a protocol or like a storage in a data center is it's not just like the access protocol. No one deploys just the access protocol. It always, there's like surrounding things. And so backup comes to mind. And while we have like a very good backup infrastructure for local storage, as soon as like you move the storage off to a file server and you want to take an application consistent snapshot, somehow you need to tell that remote side that they are now basically need to take a snapshot. So we added that with remote VSS. And another interesting observation is timeouts. iSCSI and NFS have been around for a long time, and the goal was being completely transparent, basically transparent failover. That means if you lose a node, basically you are connected to this file server, you lose that node, and you need to reconnect to this node, you must do it in a time that no application fires any timeout while you're doing the failover. Well, TCP timeouts, in the worst case, when cascading happens, you sort of can hit up to 30 seconds delay before you can really determine that you lost a connection. It's not a viable solution. There's applications, many applications like SQL start filing warnings when you hit more than 30 seconds, especially I/O timeouts. So in order to get around that, we created that witness protocol that actively monitors the membership in a cluster and cuts down that time dramatically. We've seen failover times for sort of planned failover is almost instant, and unplanned failover is now, like the best we see is around 3 seconds. So within 3 seconds, you reconnect. And that is completely transparent to the applications. They just stall I/O a little.
We've also done quite a bit with lots of connections. So we'll fail over 20,000 connections in about 20 seconds. So it's meant for both the home directory workload as well as server application workloads.
Transparency is a key thing. And so you can't do it like for just in small scale. And the last one sort of as a surrounding thing is when you think about documents being stored on these servers, then access control becomes really, really important. And for large organizations like our own, we have like 100,000 employees, but in order to protect all the documents the right way, people have created about 1 million security groups. And so that's an incredible number. It also means whenever you have like an auditor come to your company and you're supposed to basically check on compliance with like the laws with regards to document retention and document keeping, it's you can't enforce it anymore. Nobody can check whether 1 million security groups make any sense. So we added a new form of authorization that's based on claims. So there's some attributes that are given to users at the time of login. Those are either like random Active Directory attributes, but can also be physical. Like the person is logging on from a machine that has BitLocker enabled, so where the data is encrypted at rest. That's a requirement for keep certain types of data on your laptop. So unless you actually have that attribute, we can now say, hey, you have access or not. In fact, we can have like arbitrary Boolean expressions in the ACLs, which is really going to change the way people think about access to documentation. So this is the SMB history. Now let's talk about some other aspects of work we did in SMB in Server 2012. SMB on its own is just a protocol. What people really want to buy is file servers. And we looked at the sort of the hardware market, and we looked at what's happening to our share of file servers all over the world. And what we found is people still buying servers, but they're less and less using them as file servers. And we tried to understand why is that. Like, why are people using less file servers? And it came down to, well, people want high availability, which we don't provide. So we address that at the protocol level. But we also need to address it at the storage level. And the other thing, the management model of having to basically stand up multiple individual servers plus a storage backend, then configuring it all to getting it up in clustering mode was just not very appealing. So there were a lot of things in terms of disk management and cluster management was just too hard. And people would much rather buy like a network appliance, kind of a filer, where you got a lot of these things coming out of the box. And so in addition to the protocol, we invested heavily in some of the underlying services. And we have like a completely new NTFS check disk system. The big problem is you have like 4 terabyte drives, but if you ever have to run check disk on a 4 terabyte drive, that means you might have to take that disk offline for a day. There's not much about continuous availability in that model. In terms of the expenses, we require pretty high-end storage, so we basically build a new block storage layer where we build into the system the ability to just take a bunch of disks, have them as an elastic storage pool, and grab them for both local machines as well as clustered, and do something we call storage spaces that allows you to basically define virtual disks out of these pools and then determine what kind of redundancy you want to have. You can have them mirrored or you can have them with parity and so on. We had a deduplication. I already talked about that. And deduplication is, just talked about redundancy, exactly the opposite. Deduplication is kind of a risky business if you really think about it. Like you have a set of 1,000 files, you take all the segments that are sort of equal, squeeze them out of that data set, throw the originals away, and you store them all in small chunks and hope you can eventually reconstruct the original data. But if you happen to lose like one of those chunks that is like highly used, you not just destroyed one file, but you destroyed potentially hundreds of files or thousands of files. So we spend a lot of time thinking through how to basically do that in a way that doesn't sort of make the whole system less reliable. But holding on to the data really, really tight is very important when you do deduplication. And then the management of standing up a file server was just impossible. You had to use at least three different graphical tools defining storage depending on whether that was on a SAN array or whether it was local storage, and then sort of defining the volumes, eventually defining the shares. It was like all different tools, and there was like no rhyme or reason to it. It was all organically grown over 20 years. And so we made a clean cut, and we're going to offer basically a single UI that basically gets you out there from raw disks to shares in just a few clicks. And we did some initial work on working with hardware partners to take advantage of existing hardware, but I skipped that here. Whoops. That was wrong. Let's just talk about CheckDisk. So one of the observations with CheckDisk was that most of the time, while the volume was offline, we were scanning. We were scanning the disk for problems. And so an obvious solution to basically reducing the time you have to take the volume offline is that you do the scanning while the volume is still online. You record all the problems, and then you only take it offline and make the fixes for the time you perform the fixes. So that's exactly how we ended up doing. What we ended up doing is we can basically now, in the background, while you're working with the volume, you can take a snapshot, and then you start basically doing a check disk on the, you start running the scanning parse on the snapshot. You mark all the problems, and once you basically have done that, then the administrator at his leisure can determine when to take the disk offline to do the corrections. What that sort of at a top level, what that means, the offline time of a volume is no longer proportional to the number of objects on the volume, but to the number of corruptions. So if you have three corruptions, they might take like half a second or like a second to repair. It doesn't matter how large the volume is. The offline time is no longer determined by that. Of course, that's still not quite continuous, right? I mean, when you still have to take it offline, that's not continuous. So for a cluster, we integrated that with our cluster shared volumes, where you can now run check disk, and the time where the volume is taken offline is sort of virtualized away and hidden from the applications. So it, again, it leads to the I/O stalls for a few seconds and then just continues. If there is like a massive number of repairs that you can't deal with in one repair phase, so it repairs for like a few seconds, I think up to 5 seconds is the repair phase, that brings it back online, lets the application continue, and then sort of does multiple of those in sequence. But it's completely seamless. You don't have to do anything about it. If you use cluster shared volumes, you can run check disk without any interruption. If you happen to hit, of course, a corrupted file, there's nothing we can do. But for most parts, most of the system can continue to run. Storage spaces. It's really sort of like a concept that most of you probably know around from systems like ZFS, where you basically have pools of disks. You can put them together. You can extend them. You can just add drives if you run out of space. You carve out virtual disks. Those are thinly provisioned or can be thinly provisioned. So you're really saving space. And you get pretty reliable storage out of like standard components. There's nothing special, no hardware that you need. One of the more interesting features here, though, is that we do support this on clusters. So again, there's the continuous availability aspect. You can have a shared SAS subsystem where you have multiple nodes connected to the same drives, and you can still use storage spaces out of that, which is a really, really low cost, much, much, much lower cost alternative to anything that's available on the market today. We're usually having to end up using fiber channel or iSCSI. And then there's sort of a whole bunch of like interesting features that make that sort of usable from a UI perspective, but I spare you sort of the details. Another thing that we at least get started in this release is the resilient file system. So there's a new file system coming out on Windows Server. And the main design point was resiliency. Customers really like to hold on to their data. It's really bad when you start losing data. And so if you claim continuous availability, holding on to your data tight is good. And so we took some lessons from some systems out there in the market and also did a lot of research ourselves. This system was written not so much optimized for performance, but very, very much focused on data resiliency. So we have checksum protection for every single metadata operation. You can turn on checksums for every data stream as well. And the scalability design point is very different. In NTFS, we have a whole bunch of different data types. Some of them scale well, some of them don't scale well. Like how many files can you have in a directory? How many directories can you have? All of those were different data types with different scalability characteristics. And it's sort of, you always sort of start chasing sort of like the smallest, the shortest stick. With REFS, there's a single data type that is very, very scalable, and all objects on disks are modeled from that scalable data model. So that was the other design point. There's a whole bunch of things that don't work right now. And let me talk about that in a little more detail. When you do a new file system, it gives you sort of time to reflect. Like the first thing you start with, hey, you want to have 100% application compatibility. But then when you really start looking at it, you find out sooner or later that there are some features that might be architecturally difficult, large, error-prone, and almost no one is using them. So as part of that new file system, we made a decision that we are not going to continue being 100% compatible to NTFS, but we will make a clean break for some features where we don't see much value going forward. We will just not support them. And right now, sort of, there's a list of the features that we're not supporting. Not all of those will be cut, but in the first release, that's where we ended up being.
So I'm puzzled as to the deduplication piece being cut, because that would seem to me that that would be something that customers would really value, even on a new file system. I can see getting rid of some of the other things, but deduplication it stands out to me on that, and I wonder if you could comment.
Yeah.
What are the ones you would prefer to get rid of?
Oh, things like name streams, EAs, short names, compression and encryption. Yeah, probably quotas too. Yeah, I mean, most of the other things I really don't care about. The transactional stuff, I never ever saw that in use, really. So like I say, deduplication, that's the one piece it looks like people would really want, and I'm kind of surprised it's not there.
Well, it's an interesting technical argument, so let me walk you through it. I talked about how basically the core, the on-disk format is completely different, and the data structures in REFS are very different. And we have sort of like the metadata streams are very reliable modeled out of those core data structures. The way deduplication works on NTFS is that we basically create files that act as chunk stores, and then we have like metadata files that sort of index into these chunk stores. We have reparse points, and then once you hit a reparse point, that's an index into one of those metadata nodes, and then we basically reconstruct the original file. That's all pretty done in a pretty pedestrian way, and all the data redundancy and resiliency is done very manual. We're definitely going to put deduplication on REFS, but if you put that on there, we will not invent our own data structures. We will integrate it at the level that we're leveraging the REFS data structures.
Right.
And so there will be deduplication on REFS, but we just didn't have the time because REFS was developed in parallel to deduplication. And so in the next version, I would expect that we will move that forward, but it will look different. The compression and deduplication algorithms will be very similar, but like the implementation in terms of the data structures, the disk layout will be completely different.
Can you elaborate on what type of deduplication it is?
Sure. There's some raw categories, like some people do like deduplication based on blocks. Some people do it based on files. We have been shipping single instance storage like in previous releases. This one is based on variable size chunks with variable offsets. So it's not a synchronous process, it's an asynchronous process. So we're not getting in the middle of the write pass, but sort of you have a policy. After a certain time, files have not been touched. We process them, and we basically scan them and look for sort of similarity with the existing elements in the chunk store and build a chunk store like that. We ran about, it's a project we did together with our research department. We spent about 2 years looking at various algorithms, and on sort of our standard information worker workload, we're seeing about 60% compression. For virtual images, or we're running on our build servers, we're seeing between 80 and 90% compression rate. It's a combination of both deduplication and compression. Now, there seem to be, I was a little taken aback earlier today about sort of the lack of enthusiasm where we're sort of, which phase we're entering with SMB. And like one of our goals was, so we did all that innovation and a lot of the work around continuous availability, but we didn't really have machines that people can buy that bring that value proposition to the customer in an easy way. So we did a lot of work, but it would never land at the customers because it was just too complex. So at the beginning of the release, we also started reaching out into the ODM and OEM community and trying to get basically machines that sort of are blueprints for what a file server should look like, a continuously available file server. And so the basic model is you have like redundant power supplies, you have two or more servers, you have a shared SAS passive backplane where you can have shared storage that is visible from all the nodes. And then you want to be able to buy one of those boxes and 15 minutes later you can share files. And those file servers there are amazingly performant, and the price point of a solution like this is a lot less than having to buy individual servers plus a storage subsystem. So by putting this all into a single case, you get rid of a lot of cables, you get rid of a lot of sources of problems, and we're seeing a lot of excitement around this. So for this release, this is probably for SMB in particular, like the most exciting time we have seen in the last 5 years. We have a show coming up in June, TechEd, where we're going to probably show about 10 different designs from all these new vendors. And so quite the opposite to where we see SMB has reached the peak. This is sort of like definitely a peak ahead that we're expecting to see in the next couple of months. Now, so the tenor of like a lot of what we've heard earlier was kind of like, remind me of this quote. And I don't quite agree, sort of I much rather like it sort of Mark Twain. It's difficult to predict the future, make predictions so special about the future. So everything, we're transitioning to the part of the meeting where we make predictions about the future. I have no right to do that, and everything I say might be wrong, and we might not do it. But let me phrase it as like when we look at the market, these are the kinds that we think about, the problems we're seeing and the challenges we're seeing ahead of us. And I'm going to do that with Jim.
So when you look at the work that Thomas just went through, a lot of it was around taking an existing market, the Santa Ray market, the iSCSI target market, and trying to transform that market to be able to use file shares. So instead of being stuck with this block abstraction that's very difficult to use, but very established in the market, we were trying to transform what server application storage was to be file-based in very real ways, both in terms of our products, SQL and Hyper-V, which have never supported file shares before, and now both support them and actually prefer them. So it, in many ways, opens up a whole new market for us. As a community. That's really what we tried to focus on in this release in terms of being server application focused. When you look forward, though, the world is changing around us. And to me, a lot of what's happening in the world and changing is that we're now moving to a cloud design point where the hardware and the systems and the services that we're putting together need to work in these very large-scale data centers. And they have completely different design points than what we're used to. The design point that we really went through in these last few slides is around single points of failure. You can't have any single point of failure. As soon as you get one failure, you mask it as quickly as you can. That was kind of our design approach. Some people take a design approach that says we're going to have fully redundant systems working in lockstep, and we can fail over in milliseconds. And so your outage time is almost not even measurable. For us, what we did was we said it's actually okay if you have a temporary stall in an I/O for a few seconds if you have a single fault. And then we'll mask that and fail over, and everything will continue without any errors. In the cloud space, they don't want a single failure kind of fault tolerance. What they want to be able to avoid is any kind of critical situation. And so if you've got, for instance, only two nodes in a cluster in a box config, like what we just showed you, in that configuration, if you lose one of those two nodes, you're down to a single node is fronting all the data that's behind it. If that single node goes down, you lose access to your data. That is a critical situation for them. As soon as that fires, as soon as that first node dies, they have to deploy somebody into their data center or somebody into their container. And so the serviceability model of that is absolutely unacceptable to the new cloud way of actually managing the data center. They never want crit-sit situations unless you get a whole series of faults. And then yes, then they'll have to deploy someone. And so that's when you start going through the different levels of fault tolerance that cloud design centers need. They need to have at least dual disk fault tolerance, not just single disk. So a RAID 5 type solution is absolutely unacceptable. The numbers of disks that they deploy are absolutely insane in aggregate, although in some design points they only put 4 or 5 or 10 disks off of a single server. In other design points, we have one group, Bing Maps, that's putting 480 disks behind a cluster of file servers for a total of 1.5 petabytes of storage sitting behind it. And in that world, losing 1.5 petabytes of data, or access to what 1.5 petabytes of data, is absolutely unacceptable. So there's a series of design points when you start looking at the physical hardware in a cloud environment. How do you go about powering down a rack, for example, so you can service components? Or how do you upgrade operating systems? Or how do you patch operating systems? And so they have fault tolerance models for how they can power these things down and upgrade it along a row on in the data center, or on a rack in a data center. And so now physical placement of where you actually put the storage matters. And so you end up with a lot of these different kinds of new design constraints when you start going into cloud environments, where how you place your storage matters. It's not just the performance, it's not just the level of fault tolerance you provide, but it's actually where you physically place it so that you can have this ability to power down sections of the data center and still have full access to the data. As soon as you start doing that, then you also end up having to start dealing with multiple data centers. That's the other design point, is they want to be able to lose power to a data center. What blew me away when I started going out and visiting some of our data centers is how much money they spent on power supplies. They would go out and spend millions on these huge diesel generators that they would keep warm at 300 degrees, so the oil would be nice and warm, so that they could fire the things on in under a second, somewhere between a second and 30 seconds. And so they had these massive rooms of batteries to cover the entire data center for that 1 second to 30 second period while they're turning on these diesel generators that are about as big as this room to power the entire data center. And so they have the design constraints that they have are very different. And that expense is getting so bad for those diesel generators that the new design point is they just want to kill the entire data center. If they lose power due to the grid going out, they want to just fail over to another data center. And so then when you're placing your data, it's not just about making sure you have multiple copies and placing them in the appropriate spots in the rack. You also now have to think about placing it across multiple data centers as well. So this gets into the geo replication design point, and it gets into thinking about what we talked about previously was a cluster and being able to transparently fail over within a cluster. And now potentially you have a cluster of clusters where you don't necessarily want the same tight coupling between data centers, but you do want the tight coupling within a data center. So you can fail over very quickly, and maybe fail over less quickly when you go between data centers. In that same context, there's other things going on in the cloud design area, specifically around Hadoop. If you look at some of the new models for how they're actually deploying storage, what they do, our community is kind of focused on having all of storage behind a file server. And so compute is separate from storage. So I call that disaggregated storage, or you've pulled the storage away from the compute. In the Hadoop model, they actually have design points that are very targeted at what I would call embarrassingly parallel I/O. And so they intentionally, what's called shard the data, they spread the data across all the nodes in a cluster, and then design the application so that it's hitting local I/O. And so in the world where you have, say, 1,000 machines, and each individual machine gives you, say, a gigabyte of bandwidth, round numbers and looking forward a couple years, across that 1,000 machines, I get 1,000 gigabytes per second. It's a huge number. Whereas if I went to the file server, if I tried to put all of that to a single file server, I would have to have 1,000 10 gigabit Ethernet interfaces. No one's going to deploy that. And so to me, there's this design space that comes in where under some application problems, you actually want to shard your data and spread it across a whole bunch of nodes. And in other, sharding is actually quite painful. Because of that, you actually lose the ability to aggregate your storage, and then you end up with what I call orphan storage on each individual node, because you're, say, sharding your data at 128 megabyte granularity or something across all your different nodes. You've got, say, 100 megabytes on this node and 60 megabytes on that node and 5 terabytes on this other node, and you can't shard your data now. Right? You have to actually take out nodes. So if you had aggregated storage, if you had a file server, it's actually easier to manage. And so to me, what needs to happen is over time, we need to move into a place where you've got a namespace that can potentially take you all the way from having all of your storage behind a file share to having this sharded storage in a clustered environment. So you can have this embarrassingly parallel, very high-scale storage. And they're really, to me, two different design points in terms of hardware, just like we walked through before. We have different design points in terms of hardware. But we ought to be able to create a software infrastructure that can allow the same I/O model and the same namespace from the application's perspective to work across all. We're getting tight on time, so I'm going to race ahead a little. As you start playing with the namespace then and being able to integrate these two different deployment models where you've got disaggregated storage or co-located storage and compute, that same capability could potentially allow you to be able to span with this virtualized namespace, something that's got to be much fancier than DFS namespace, for example, be able to span an on-prem storage capability with cloud capability. So that you could potentially create a unified namespace between those two and be able to potentially even migrate data between them. If you start going down the migration path, being able to move data from on-prem into the cloud or from the cloud onto on-prem, clearly you're not going to be doing that live, or you're going to have huge performance issues. Your performance will vary radically depending upon where your storage is. And so arguably at that point you want to bring in sync architectures to allow you to be able to have potentially multiple copies, stale or what we're calling coherent or non-coherent. And so you then potentially have to have versioning that is associated with the files because you have a sync, you have a sync copy number 57 versus sync copy number 58. And so you need to be able to deal with eventual consistency as part of the file system namespace. And then, of course, as part of that, you might have filtering as well, because you don't want to replicate the entire data set between one data center and another, or your on-prem resource and your cloud resource. So those kinds of things all come into this new cloud-focused design point. There's several other aspects. We can talk about it afterwards. One key issue to me, though, is also archival. As you start getting into some of these very, very large storage environments, you need to be able to potentially hold on to that storage for 10, 20 years. All of the archival work that was done over the last 10 years, to me, needs to go more mainstream. We need to be able to ensure, now that we have new types of file systems like REFS, where we have checksums on all the data, we now have the raw ability to be able to validate that the data is exactly what was originally stored there. It hasn't been modified. And that core capability enables long-term retention. And so those kinds of APIs need to be exposed to the application to allow the application to be able to validate that and trust that, in fact, the copy that was stored 20 years ago is, in fact, the copy that they have today. And lastly, on devices.
It came up earlier, sort of the endpoints are not necessarily, the majority of the endpoints are not necessarily computers anymore or laptops. The majority of the endpoints already are turned to mobile devices. And the model in which you would interact with, like your data store, is not necessarily like a browse model as we used to. And so we talked about like the sync model. The protocol becomes an interesting question. SMB, as it stands now, isn't really well suited to run over the open internet, but we can change that anything we like. And then there's all these interesting problems that come from sort of the joint model where you have both an enterprise and you have like some data there. There's privacy issues around that authorization, and you have sort of your cloud identities, and how do you bring those two worlds together and allow like cross access from both sides. With that, I think we're out of time. Any questions? Steve.
Where is the question? Thanks.
So in the list you had earlier of REFS features, obviously for me doing Linux, it's particularly interesting to make sure the minimum set is there for POSIX, so we could remotely run against REFS. And I wasn't sure exactly from that list whether that was set in stone. I realized Jeremy started to ask that follow-up question. But, for example, hard links, will we likely get hard links at some point? Is this a temporary list of restrictions?
This is what the restrictions are today. And we basically, there's a big bet. The company will bet on REFS. So we will basically build that out in the future releases. Hard links sounds like a very likely candidate that will come, yes.